This Is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we take you with us as we explore Philip Johnson's glass house in New Canaan, Connecticut. The 49-acre property opened to the public in 2007. It was the focus of one of my first feature stories for WNPR. Almost 10 years later, I wanted to go back to see how this iconic landmark in modernist architecture is still capturing the attention of not just architects, but tourists from around the world. The glass house is what brings people to this pastoral property, but Johnson's evolution as an architect is spread throughout, from the glass house to the brick house, to the subterranean art gallery, to his sculpture gallery. Irene Shum is curator of the glass house. She starts our tour at Johnson's bright red and strangely shaped postmodern building, known as De Monsta.
If you look at the glass house as a property, we begin with the glass house, which is very geometric, and at that time Johnson was interested in Platonic forms, and so you have this, you know, circles, rectangles, pure geometry. And by the end of life, or towards the end of life, he was interested in complex geometries, and so we have this very irregular shaped building that is both black and red, one room, and each color indicates a form. And each form has its own purpose. So one is, again, it was designed as the visitor center. So the red section is where you would welcome guests. And the black section is what he called the theater. And so right now we have sculpture inside the Monsta.
Now, I had read that this is Johnson's, you know, because of Mies van der Rohe, mm-hmm. the Farnsworth house. This was his version of that. Can you talk a little bit about, first, who Mies van der Rohe was and their relationship and how Johnson came to create the glass house?
Johnson joined the MoMA, which was recently founded. MoMA was founded in 1929, and Johnson joined on a staff in 1930. And in discussion or at the request of Alfred Barr, who was then the MoMA's founding director. And Johnson was the founding director of the Department of Architecture, and he was organizing their first exhibition. And his first exhibition, he wanted to highlight what he considered modern architecture. And he was much more interested in the movements in Germany and in the Netherlands, whereas in New York at that time, what was considered modern architecture was more Art Deco. Mm-hmm. And he was more interested in the Bauhaus, these utilitarian forms. And so as he was traveling in Europe, he came upon Mies van der Rohe's studio. And Mies plays an important figure in Johnson's life or in his professional career and interests. He immediately gravitates towards Mies. Several of Mies's projects are included in the international exhibition that he's organizing. But he also then employs Mies to be the architect of his apartment in New York City, because he wanted his apartment to showcase this new modern architecture. And so, again, Mies is someone who Johnson imitates. Mm-hmm. And after this exhibition, he continues to be enthralled with Mies. You know, Johnson leaves the MoMA, eventually goes to architecture school, and then after architecture school, actually returns to MoMA. In 1946, he's organizing an exhibition of Mies's work. And around that time, in the discussion and planning of this exhibition, he's meeting with Mies. He's at Mies's studio. Mies is now designing a house for Edith Farnsworth, and they are discussing creating a house of glass. And there are interviews where Johnson is talking with Mies of, oh, this is impossible, how do you do it? And so Johnson sees what Mies is drawing, sees his models, and then has an aha moment and designs his own glass house. But I'd like to be clear that the glass house, Philip Johnson started designing his personal residence in 1945 as well, so the same time as Mies. But what he does is he's designing a house for himself before he even has property. He actually finds the property here in New Canaan in 1946. And we'll walk over, once we get to the glass house, we'll talk about how he decides to buy the land here. But Johnson goes through 29 different schematic designs. So he's really working out, you know, what is my house going to be? And before arriving at this final design that we see in front of us. And so it was a long process. It wasn't simply, oh, I saw this model and I saw this drawing and now I'm going to make my own. It was a process of finding out what was right for him.
So how about we walk closer to the glass house and get a closer look?
Today, where we live, we're taking you with us on a tour of Philip Johnson's glass house in New Canaan, Connecticut. Curator Irene Shum leads us down a gravel path to the treasured landmark.
So we've walked inside the glass house. Tell us about this structure. Again, it was built in 1949, is that correct?
Yes, the glass house was completed in 1949, and the glass house is actually two structures. It is a courtyard house. It's both the glass house and the brick house. If you can think of the glass house as the main house and the brick house as the guest house, and they're connected by a gravel path that runs between a lawn. And people often ask, did he live here? And Johnson considered the glass house his primary residence. So the way, and his career was in New York, and the way he broke his week was he spent, when he was younger, 4 days in New York, and then three in New Canaan. And then later, it was 3 days in New York, 4 days in New Canaan. And then later in life, after retirement, it was full time in the glass house. Philip Johnson did live here with his partner, and in fact, he died inside the glass house in 2005 in January. So he regarded this as his primary residence.
Earlier you said that Philip Johnson started his design for the glass house much earlier than when he found the property. So how did he find this place in New Canaan?
Philip Johnson studied at Harvard Graduate School of Design, and his teacher, Marcel Breuer, had recently moved to New Canaan. And so while visiting and looking for property, he also started to look in New Canaan because Marcel Breuer was here, as was Elliot Noyes. And during the weekend, they stopped along Ponis Ridge Road, and they walked down this parcel. And at that time, the descriptions, as Johnson has been quoted, was that it was entirely wooded. But he came upon this natural promontory that we see to our west. There is a dramatic drop in the property, and this natural vista is the reason why Johnson purchased this property. Now, to my left is a very large oak tree. And this oak tree was here in 1949. And Johnson said, I use this oak tree, I hang my hat off of it. So if you can think of the oak tree as this place where, off of which the glass house is hung. And the glass house is situated on this natural promontory. And as we look to the west, you have this incredible naturalistic vista. It's a landscape of meadows and forests. It looks very natural, but in fact, it's highly sculpted by Johnson.
You'd said that Philip Johnson and his partner David Whitney actually did live here. I mean, most people can't imagine living in a glass house. So what did he say about the space once it was created, and he lived here for so many years?
I don't know if this is, there was an off-color remark, I don't know if it's fit for radio, but where people would ask, how I could never live here, and then his response is, madam, I haven't asked you to.
He was quite the character, so maybe we could talk about, you know, who was Philip Johnson, what was he like?
He was really known for his wit, and so there are all these lovely quotes and anecdotes about Philip Johnson.
His wit, not his snark.
Snark. Snark included.
What about the brick house? So you'd mentioned that they are together in terms of the residence of the glass house. So I mean, during the day, did Philip and David spend time here and then they retire? I mean, how did the collaboration go between these two properties?
Well, the brick house is the counterpoint to the glass house. And in fact, the glass house couldn't exist as this pure form without the brick house. The brick house only has two rooms, a guest bedroom and a reading room library and a bathroom. It has a very large utility closet, a clothes closet, and the mechanical room is located there. And all the mechanicals, you see none in the glass house, are run through an underground conduit that parallels the path between the brick and the glass house. So that's where your electrical, your plumbing, your then telephone wires would go through and then come up through the fireplace and then spread out. So the brick house is fundamental. As far as usages, I've heard from Frank Gehry that Philip Johnson would nap in the guest room maybe during the day, but he had a bed here in the glass house, and so he resided here.
There must have been some fabulous parties here.
There's some wonderful photos by David McCabe. In fact, we will have a David McCabe exhibition this fall that will feature some of these social highlights with Andy Warhol and Robert Stern, for example, inside these photographs.
You did a great job describing how the glass house sits on this cliff and there's meadows all around us. Can you talk a little bit about how Philip Johnson, I guess, crafted that to fit with the view that he had inside the glass house? I mean, there's certain things where they cut down, or how did he get this view, or is it just all natural?
Philip Johnson considered himself a better landscape architect than an architect. And at the glass house, the landscape is essentially three components. There are lawns, meadows, and forests. What Philip Johnson does to create this naturalistic look is that he does several things. First, he limbs up the trees, and so to create these strong verticals, and then he cuts into the forests. He clears and cuts into the forests and removes trees, and you can see there are three right in front of us. He cuts them into these triangles. He's playing with perspective, and he draws our eyes further into the property to create a sense of perspective and trying to exaggerate the space. And by doing so, he enlarges the space. And another idiom that he does, or another trope that he does, is he clears the ground so there is no underbrush. Mm-hmm. So by clearing the ground and limbing the trees up, you have these open spaces, and that lets light in, and you have this wonderful play of light, shade, and shadow on the property. It's very picturesque.
We're talking with Irene Shum. She's curator of the Philip Johnson Glass House in New Canaan, Connecticut. Since it opened to the public in 2007, thousands of visitors have come to this unique house and property, complete with more than a dozen modern and postmodern buildings. When we come back from the break, we'll hear how Johnson's legacy includes showcasing talented artists from around the world. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Today, Where We Live, we're taking you on a tour of the Philip Johnson Glass House in New Canaan. Nestled among beautiful views of Connecticut's countryside, curator Irene Shum talks to us inside the glass house. Later, we'll head down into the valley below the house, where Johnson designed a lovely pavilion and pond. It's the site of the latest artist exhibition there. I had read that Philip Johnson brought together a lot of talented people, and I'm curious about his legacy here, now that he's gone, not just his estate, but the collaboration that the Philip Johnson Glass House has with the artist community, including what we're seeing in front of us, if you want to describe.
We're very lucky here at the Glass House. Philip Johnson was a patron of the arts, so to maintain his legacy, we have invited artists, architects, dancers, musicians to the property, and we were to perform, and we commission work. We also bring work in. But so because of this, the temporary exhibitions and public programs continue the legacy of Philip Johnson and David Whitney as art patrons. Now, this year is our 10th tour season. It happens to be, as well, Philip Johnson's 110th birthday anniversary. And to celebrate this, we invited Yayoi Kusama. Yayoi Kusama is a Japanese artist. She's 88 years old, based out of Tokyo. And she had for a period between 1958 to 1973 live in New York and practice, and as it happens. And Philip Johnson did collect her work. In fact, one of her works at the Museum of Modern Art, Accumulation of Stamps, was purchased by Johnson in 1962 and then donated to the MoMA in 1970. So when thinking about what to plan for this year, I really hoped to do something fun and celebratory. I really wanted to have an artist who could, whose work would be displayed in the Lower Meadow. And so here we are inside the glass house, looking down at the Lower Meadow. Again, this is a vast amount of space. It's more than half the property. And thinking about what artist or architect or creative person could create a piece that would hold this space visually and be interesting, Yayu Kusama was one of a very select few that could do it. And I thought Narcissus Garden would be really beautiful in the pond.
So we're looking down, and it's like these silvery orbs are moving with the wind and the pond as it moves along.
Yes. The glasshouse is located actually on the east face of the Ripawam River Valley, and so we have our own microclimate here. The winds come down from the northwest during the mornings, and then around midday, because we are close to the Long Island Sound, we get the tidal winds, and the winds shift, and they come from the southeast and move northwest. And then, again, towards the evening, it quiets down. So although the pond is not tidal, because of the wind patterns, all of these orbs continue to move. Now, there are 1,300 of these stainless steel orbs. They are mirrored finish. They create this very glittering effect when viewed from the promontory. What's nice about this particular piece, or Narcissus Garden, is it is a work that we can view from near or afar. From here, it has this beautiful shimmering effect, and you can see it from many different angles from the property. They're moving right now.
Yeah, it's really lovely.
It's very meditative. Here we are in the pond, in the pavilion in the pond, and when we look up, we can see the glass house. And then when we look out into the pond, we can see Yayoi Kusama's Narcissus Garden, again, first created in 1966. Yayoi Kusama is someone who, it's well known that she, as an artist, has suffered from hallucinations and mental health issues. What I really appreciate about her work is, for her, she uses art to, for me, what her work is about the triumph of art, and it's art's ability to transform pain into meaning and beauty. Another thing that Kusama is known for is one of her idioms is the polka dot. Now, the polka dot, she says, is she regards as an individual, and she is one polka dot among billions. And so when you look at Narcissus Garden, this particular work is comprised of 1,300 spheres. Each sphere is about, it's 30 inches in diameter, so it's just under a foot. And they are in the pond, and they, if you think of the way Kusama looks at the world, watching these spheres move around the water, it becomes very contemplative and meditative. You can think of just even human dynamics and how sometimes these spheres move in groups, then they move together. Sometimes they split apart. Sometimes they're single ones moving on their own. It is a metaphorical work.
You're hearing Narcissus Garden and the silvery orbs that are moving in the pond, reflecting the afternoon sun. From the pond, we walk up and through parts of the 49-acre campus that include the art and sculpture galleries and Johnson's library, where he was most productive. Glasshouse curator Irene Shum takes us inside.
So here we are in the library study. The library study has three walls of books, and this contains Philip Johnson's architectural library. The north wall is our monographs, and right next to the door is a small shelf of rare books, and the other two walls are filled with books about architectural types. There is one wall or one window that looks out into the forest, but in the library study, there's only a desk and a fireplace. And Philip Johnson had called this his monk's cell. He would come here to work. He said that he found working in the glasshouse too distracting. This is actually probably my second favorite space. It's just, it's really peaceful. And I feel it right now. I'm just like, oh, it's just, I could be here and meditate.
So while he was still living, he had made the decision that he wanted this this property to go to the National Trust for Historic Preservation?
Philip Johnson is known as an architect and someone who really advanced the art of his time. What's lesser known is that he was an active preservationist. In fact, he became involved in preservation in 1964 with the proposed razing of Penn Station in New York. There are these wonderful archival photographs of him picketing with signs with Jane Jacobs in front of the old Penn Station to try and stop its demolition. The demolition of, or the razing of Penn Station took 4 years. It's from 1964 to 68. And so after the destruction of Penn Station, Philip Johnson actually became a trustee of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. He served on its board from 1968 to 71. And during this period, he got the idea to donate this property to the National Trust for Historic Preservation. The discussions for the donation began in 1979 and then were finalized in 1986. And at that time, if you can imagine, Philip Johnson is 80 years old. And so the trust allows him to have life estate, and he continues to live until he's 98 and dies in January 2005. So this property was gifted to the trust in 1986, and he had planned for its transfer.
What are some of the, I guess, unusual events and opportunities that you have here for people who want to visit?
At the Glasshouse, we have now great temporary exhibitions, but we have an excellent and very ambitious public programs, which include live events, dance performances, and music performances. Actually, this fall, it'll be a small performance by Ryuichi Sakamoto and Alva Noto, who were nominated for the Golden Globes and BAFTA for The Revenant, for example. I would say that an important aspect of the legacy of Philip Johnson is this idea of being a patron of the arts and supporting the artists. And so artwork, exhibitions and our programs and our performances that start here then go on and live. And we're very proud of that, to be able to support and continue to sustain the arts.
You can visit the Glasshouse now through November. And Yayoi Kusama's exhibition, Narcissus Garden, is included on the tour. If you wait until September, you'll see the Glasshouse like it's never been seen before, covered in Kusama's red polka dots. This special installation called Dots Obsession will run through the end of September. To see pictures and video from our visit to the Glasshouse, you can go to wmpr.org/where we live or visit Where We Live's Facebook page. Thanks to WMPR's digital reporter, Ryan Karen King. When we come back from the break, an interview with a historian who has significant details about another controversial part of architect Philip Johnson's life. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today, Where We Live, we've taken you along with us to the iconic Glasshouse in New Canaan, Connecticut. It's the home of Philip Johnson and his partner, David Whitney, which opened to the public in 2007. Since then, thousands of people from across the globe have visited the home of the famed architect. But before Johnson changed the landscape of U.S. architecture to favor modernist design, Johnson had political interests that are surprising. Author Mark Wortman wrote about Johnson's Nazi past in a Vanity Fair article. That article stems from his research for his new book, 1941, Fighting the Shadow War, A Divided America in a World at War. Mark Wortman joins us by phone. Hi, Mark. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
So I know this is an all-encompassing book. Summarize for us how you started to look at the Shadow War and Johnson's place in that time.
Sure. In the period before December 7th, 1941, when the U.S. was attacked at Pearl Harbor, the whole world was at war except for the United States. The U.S. was nominally neutral and at peace with every nation on Earth, but we were caught up deep in the wars that were going on in Europe and in Asia, and we were simultaneously going to war. And also debating within the United States what the proper role should be for America in these wars. And so there was this tremendous divisive argument and sometimes actual violent fights in America over what we should be doing. And there were many different factions that ranged from out-and-out fascists, Nazi supporters within the U.S., to liberals and social democrats who viewed the war in Europe in particular as not America's business. And so in my book, I trace out a number of exemplary figures in that that debate and fight here, as well as some aspects of the military history of that period when the U.S. was engaged in an undeclared war with Hitler, and in the context of what you've been talking about today, Philip Johnson emerged as a significant figure because of his fanatic devotion to Nazism mm-hmm. in America and his connections to Nazi Germany.
In the Vanity Fair article, you write that Johnson was no stranger to Europe. He came from a wealthy family from Cleveland. He traveled to Germany often with his mother. But if I'm reading this right, it was in 1932 when Nazism really grabbed him. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah. Well, actually, even before Hitler came to power, mm-hmm. In 1932, Johnson, that was, and I should say that was an extraordinary year for Johnson. That was the year in which he curated the International Style and Architecture exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art, and that really set the future course for American and eventually world architecture in adopting modernism as the great style in architecture for the 20th century. That took place in 1932. Mm-hmm. And not long after that exhibit opened, Johnson returned to Germany, where he'd spent a lot of time in Weimar, Germany. And while there, at the recommendation of a friend, he went to a National Socialist Party rally outside of Berlin, and he saw Hitler for the first time. And this was before Hitler had come to power. And he was completely smitten. He found the experience totally febrile, as he said. And he basically, from that point on, became an acolyte of Nazism and a devoted proselytizer for Nazism in America.
Go ahead.
Oh, and he returned to the United States, and he began to work for political causes with the purpose of bringing fascism to America or creating an American version of fascism.
In your book, again, 1941, Fighting the Shadow War, Divided America in a World at War, you write that Johnson traveled back and forth between the U.S. and Germany. But I was curious, you know, we hear often about Philip Johnson as this world-renowned architect, but, you know, he was also a gay man. He also was a proponent of the modernist movement. These are two things that Nazism, you know, was not about, and they actually targeted. So how did he reconcile that if he was such a fascist?
Yeah. That's, you know, how he could hold the two in his mind is hard for me to explain, but, you know, Johnson had a very active homosexual lifestyle, life, and you know he and much of he had many gay friends in Germany, and he had many friends in the modernist architecture community in Germany, particularly associated with the Bauhaus. And the Bauhaus was closed down by the Nazis, and the Nazis considered homosexuality something that was punishable by death. So he actually aided some friends from the Bauhaus in emigrating to the United States. But he wrote an article in which he described, in which he said that if Nazism is setting the clock back at the moment, it's only so that they can take that much farther a leap ahead in the future. Mm. You know, and he wasn't alone in this view of Nazism as somehow a revolution that needed to be accommodated. Anne Morrow Lindbergh, Charles Lindbergh's wife, wrote a book in 1940, a number one bestseller called The Wave of the Future, in which she called Nazism scum on the wave of the future as the world was passing through a revolutionary period. And that, you know, eventually this sort of froth, as she viewed it, and as I think Philip Johnson was trying to claim for it, would subside, and something new and greater would develop for the world.
Again, this is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. I'm speaking with author Mark Wortman. He's an independent historian, a freelance journalist who's written several books. His latest, 1941, Fighting the Shadow War, A Divided America in a World at War. His research includes a surprising look into Philip Johnson's political leanings. Before Johnson became a famous architect known for modernist architecture like the Glass House in New Canaan, Connecticut, you may be surprised to know that Johnson was a fascist. Mark, when I was reading your book, you know, you open up the first two chapters, and it's the profile of two journalists, one William Shire and another Philip Johnson. I was surprised to learn that he had gone over to Germany as a journalist. And can you talk about how these men were very different?
Yeah, okay. Well, let's start with William Shire. William Shire was CBS Radio News' correspondent on the continent. He lived and reported from Berlin. And his invocation, "Hello, America, this is Berlin," was nationally known. And he attempted to convey to Americans just how shocking and frightening what was going on in Nazi Germany was. His reports were censored, but eventually he couldn't stand the censorship anymore, and he came back to the United States, and he became... went around the country lecturing about Nazi Germany and the direct threat he saw to America from Nazi Germany, and urging the United States to make a decision to get into this war and to bring aid to Great Britain, which was under terrible attack, assault by the Nazis. The war began on September 1st, 1939, with the invasion of Poland by Germany. 2.5 weeks later, a group of journalists went with the German army into Poland under the auspices of the German propaganda ministry. And the propaganda ministry paired Philip Johnson with William Shire. Philip Johnson was reporting for a tabloid put out by Father Charles Coughlin. Reverend Coughlin was a radio priest, immensely popular. Millions and millions of Americans listened to him every Sunday as he broadcast over the radio. And he also had a newspaper, a tabloid called Social Justice, that was filled with anti-Semitic screeds and pro-Nazi articles, pro-German articles, and a great deal about the threat that Jews in particular represented to the world. A lot of it was just absolute drivel. Philip Johnson occasionally wrote articles for Social Justice, reporting from Europe as he traveled around the continent. So he managed to be sent by the German propaganda ministry, along with these other reporters from major news outlets, to follow the German army as they were basically mopping up resistance in Poland. And the propaganda ministry stuck Johnson together with William Shire. Mm-hmm. William Shire knew Philip Johnson was, as he said, an American fascist. And yet Philip Johnson was pumping him for information about his views and claiming that he was himself anti-Nazi. And basically, Shire thought that Johnson was there to spy on him, and he and all the other reporters just hated him.
Mm-hmm. So when did Johnson's, you know, his political leanings, the fact that he was, I see he was listed at one time as an American Nazi. When did that start to catch up with him in the U.S.?
You know, well, he continued to work with pro-Nazi groups in the United States. He went around in the East lecturing about Germany and its current state. He wrote, as I said, these occasional articles for Coughlin's Social Justice, in which he said that Americans were misinformed about Germany and about their intentions. But there were investigations that were being carried out by the government of so-called fifth columnists, Americans who were believed to be German plants in the United States, trying to basically soften up the American scene so that Americans would not advocate for intervention on behalf of the democracies in Europe, and perhaps so that the United States might one day itself be swept up by Nazi Germany. So these investigations were going on. Philip Johnson got wind of them. The FBI was trailing him. And he basically changed his spots. He went in 1940. He was 34 years old, and he went to graduate school at the Harvard Graduate School of Design. He had never gotten a formal degree in architecture, though he was a leading tastemaker in architecture by that point, and sort of was hiding in plain sight. I guess until William Shire outed him.
And long before Facebook or Twitter, right? So how did he out him in a book about his time at the Polish front?
Yeah. So William Shire, through kept a secret diary while he was a reporter in Berlin. And he kept these pages of his diaries sort of hidden within his hotel, even though he knew the Gestapo was searching it. And if you read my book, you'll find out how he managed to sneak them out of Germany under the noses of the Gestapo. And Shire then put those diaries together into a book called his Berlin Diary, which was a mega bestseller in 1941. And in it, he calls holding back no punches, he calls Philip Johnson an American fascist and an agent of the German propaganda ministry. And while Johnson was at Harvard at that point, he tried to found an anti-fascist organization, and he even got involved in some kind of civil defense group that was organized at Harvard. And people started calling him out and saying, you know, there's this fascist who is claiming to be anti-Nazi. Mm-hmm. And so he was dogged by this, although amazingly, I think, all of his compatriots in the American fascist movement were indicted for sedition during this period.
But not Philip Johnson.
But not Philip Johnson. He alone managed to avoid indictment.
All because of connections?
Well, I'm speculating. I'm speculating. But, you know, Philip Johnson was very close to the Rockefeller family. Abby Aldrich Rockefeller was the driving force behind the founding of the Museum of Modern Art. Nelson Rockefeller was the president of the Museum of Modern Art and was a contemporary of Philip Johnson, knew him well, and considered himself a connoisseur of architecture. And Nelson Rockefeller had gone to Washington, where he created an agency that was a combination of an American propaganda agency and an intelligence network set up to basically combat Nazi activities in South America. You know, the Germany had been very effective at developing its influence in South America for trade and other purposes, and Nelson Rockefeller was working to counter that effort. And he worked very closely with the FBI, and as well as congressional investigators looking into fascist activities in the United States tied to South America. And I have to believe that when these indictments were coming down and when the FBI was looking into Philip Johnson's activities and when Congress was looking into his activities, that Nelson Rockefeller may have personally intervened to basically avoid the embarrassment of the man who founded the architecture department at the Museum of Modern Art, which some people called the Rockefeller Museum, from being indicted for being a Nazi agent.
I'm speaking with Mark Wortman, the author of 1941, Fighting the Shadow War, Divided America in a World at War. Part of his book focuses in on Philip Johnson. You know, earlier we were talking about the iconic glass house in New Canaan, Connecticut, and how Philip Johnson was an icon in the architecture and art world. But he had this past, this fascist past, and that's part of Mark Wortman's new book. And I'm curious, Mark, we just have a couple more minutes. You know, how did this fascist past, how did that follow him throughout his career? Because obviously before your book, some people did know about, you know, his political leanings, but it didn't seem to impact him.
Yeah. Really, he at one point his ambition was to be the architect for the Thousand-Year Reich, but he ended up being the architect for the American Century. And it occasionally came around to bite him. He was up for a major commission for a federal project, and there was in the early 1960s, for what would have been at the time one of his most significant building projects, and the there was a background check done on him, and when his fascist past emerged, he was... they decided that he should not receive that commission. Johnson attempted to make amends to a certain degree. He gave free architectural services for the design of a synagogue in Port Chester, New York. He supposedly also offered some architectural services for a project in Israel. And he certainly had close friendships and support for many people in the architecture community who were Jewish. You know, Robert Stern, the now former dean of the Yale School of Architecture, was very close to Philip Johnson, and whom he considered a mentor in part, and has always defended him. So, you know, he... it was basically a submerged part of his life. People in the architecture community, I think, had a degree of awareness of about that that past. And basically, because Johnson was both enormously influential, very generous with young architects, and a very powerful figure in in American architecture throughout the mid-century period, you know, I think it was basically permitted to that his past was past.
I want to thank Mark Wortman, author of 1941, Fighting the Shadow War, Divided America in a World at War. A really interesting book, and I appreciate this insightful conversation. Thank you so much for your time, Mark.
Thank you, Lucy. I enjoyed it.
Our show is produced by Lydia Brown and Jeff Tyson. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. WMPR's digital editor, Heather Brandon. Executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Again, you can continue this conversation on our website, wmpr.org/where we live. When you're there, don't forget to check out a video of our tour of the Philip Johnson Glass House in New Canaan, shot beautifully by WMPR's digital reporter, Ryan Karen King. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.